This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock with the highs, lows, blows, and no-go zones. Climate change is heating up on the other side of the world, you know, in the places your news ignores, unless you live there. We'll hear about heat already beyond the Paris safe lines in India, another punishing summer in Australia, and record hot times in Tasmania and New Zealand. We've got Dr. Larry Shoup explaining the Billionaire Club, the Council on Foreign Relations, and their role in dialing down climate action, plus a teaser talk from deep greener Derek Jensen. Industrial civilization is killing us, he says. The future may be low on fun, but there are flickers of resistance. Here is reporting from the UK Independent, headlined, Anti-Pipeline Campaigners Found Not Guilty by Judge Because Protest Against Climate Change Crisis Was Legal Necessity. Here is the lead from that article in the Independent, March 28th. More than a dozen protesters who clambered into holes dug for a high-pressure gas pipeline said they had been found not responsible by a judge after hearing them argue their actions to try and stop climate change were a legal necessity. Corinna Gore, the daughter of former Vice President Al Gore, was among more than 198 people who were arrested because of their 2015 actions protesting the pipeline in West Roxbury, Massachusetts, a neighborhood of Boston. 13 people were to go to trial this week, though prosecutors downgraded their original criminal charges to one of civil infraction. That was from the Independent newspaper in Britain. Here's a quick clip of Corinna Gore after winning the lawsuit with a climate defense.
Hi, I'm Corinna Gore, and I'm with the Center for Earth Ethics at Union Theological Seminary. I was very proud to be a part of this action and this movement here against the West Roxbury Lateral Pipeline, which is part of a whole system of pipelines, a fossil fuel build-out at a time when we're already experiencing climate impacts, when we know that putting more of this pollution into the air is going to cause serious harm and death and suffering for people on the other side of the world and for our own future generations. What happened today was really important. We had a long and winding road, but essentially the people that put themselves in the way of building this fossil fuel pipeline were found not responsible by reason of necessity. And the irony of that is that we are making ourselves responsible. We are part of the movement that's standing up and saying we won't let this go by on our watch. We won't act like nothing's wrong. We're going to be speaking up in new ways. We're going to be demanding that the people who are in elected office and also the corporations who are putting their costs, the cost of their doing business for their own profits, they are putting that cost on the public. They're putting that cost on future generations. And we are taking responsibility to say no to that.
The pipeline battle continues on the west coast of Canada. The Coast Salish tribe of First Nations people are leading a charge of thousands protesting doubling a pipeline from the dirty tar sands in Alberta to the port of Vancouver. Megatankers would sail through the precious waters between the mainland and Vancouver Island. Here is an update emailed by Atiya Jafar of 350.org. Quote, it all started on March 10th when 10,000 people marched in solidarity with Coast Salish spiritual leaders who simultaneously built a watch house, a structure used by their people for generations to watch over enemies, on the path of the Kinder Morgan pipeline on Burnaby Mountain. From March 17th to 24th, 172 people were arrested at the gates of the Kinder Morgan facility on Burnaby Mountain. These courageous action takers included Indigenous activists, youth, retirees, and many others. There were some high-profile participants as well, Indigenous actress and activist Carmen Moore, the leader of the Green Party of Canada, Elizabeth May, and NDP MP Kennedy Stewart. May and Stewart become the first ever sitting MPs to be arrested in solidarity with the Indigenous fight for climate justice. That was a report from 350.org. Learn more at protecttheinlet.ca.
really wanted to be here to support the people that are taking the bold step of crossing over the injunction line.
It affects us all, obviously, but it's especially important to the Indigenous peoples, and it's important to stand with them.
We need to be on the front lines, putting our bodies on the line before they do.
Besides the work areas referred to in this being collectively as Trans Mountain sites.
Climate action is going backwards at the same time in America. The Washington Post reports March 28th that staff at the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, have been given talking points playing down human role in climate change. I'll read this from the Washington Post. The list offered suggestions on ways to talk with local communities and Native American tribes about how to adapt to extreme weather, rising seas, and other environmental challenges. Employees crafted the email, first disclosed Wednesday by the Huffington Post, on the basis of controversial and scientifically unsound statements that EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt has made about the current state of climate research. Human activity impacts our changing climate in some manner, reads one of the talking points. The ability to measure with precision the degree and extent of that impact and what to do about it are subject to continuing debate and dialogue. Another states that while there has been extensive research and numerous reports on climate change, clear gaps remain, including our understanding of the role of human activity and what we can do about it. That was from the Washington Post article by Brady Dennis and Juliet Elpern, describing what the EPA has been told to say to the public. Here is the way it looks from
the other side of the world.
Where the United States, which is historically the largest climate polluter, has pulled out of the Paris Agreement. And its president, Mr. Donald Trump, is legislating anti-climate and pro-fossil fuel policies, which will see huge increase in greenhouse gas emissions in the US. This is indeed a scary situation. A polluting United States means bad news to the world, and more so to India and other developing countries, simply because a vast majority of people are poor in our part of the world, and they are vulnerable to the impacts of climate change.
But hey, if your homes are flooded and burned out in America, don't worry. The Federal Emergency Management Agency now officially doesn't think climate change is real. Bloomberg's Richard Gonzalez has the headline, FEMA drops climate change from its strategic plan. As Bloomberg reports, quote, similarly, under a section about emerging threats, the document cites cybersecurity and terrorism. There are no references to global warming, rising sea levels, extreme weather events, or any other term related to the potential impact of rising surface temperatures. End quote from Bloomberg. I guess all the science we report here on Radio EcoShock is just fake news or a witch hunt. But let's talk about
the other side of the world,
the other half of the world. As it turns out, even when it's cold and snowy in real places like New York, Oslo, or Moscow, there is a different part of the globe where it's, like, really hot. Global heating never stops. Meanwhile, we have new reporting on the Tasmanian Sea between Australia and New Zealand. By the way, Tasmania itself has had the hottest winter from November to January ever. Funny that. New Zealand just had the hottest winter it's ever seen.
A scorching summer for some, but it's also been deadly. High temperatures claiming the life of a woman in Christchurch this week. For many, this hot spell is a big concern. Recent fires in Wanaka and Queenstown may be just a taste of what's to come.
You know, we're forecast for a really extreme day on Wednesday. You know, it gets to a situation where we won't have enough resource to deal with if we get multiple fires like that.
There have been more than 90 serious fires in the south since Christmas. And while there's a total fire ban in the region, some people aren't listening.
And for farmers down south, this dry, hot weather brings with it a long-term cost.
This paddock is supposed to be full of crops, and even this tiny patch is damaged.
So pastures, we've had a loss of a lot of the spring sown stuff this year, so that's going to be an added cost in the next couple of years.
That was from New Zealand's Channel 1, January 25, 2018. The Tasman Sea surface temperature was exceptionally high, more than about 2 degrees above average for December and part of January. That is going to have impacts on sea life that we may never know. But kelp forests and abalone have been hard hit, we know that. In an article published March 27th by the Australian ABC News Network, climatologist Dr. Blair Trewin said, "These temperatures were far above any others previously observed at that time of year in the region and extended west from New Zealand to Tasmania and mainland southeast Australia," end quote. Australia had a super hot winter, too. To get the feeling, even beyond the sweltering Australian Open tennis match, I'm going to do something unusual for this show. I'm going to play you part of a YouTube video uploaded by a user in Australia by J. May Stojanovic. It was on January 19, 2018, as this mother went through a power outage with the temperature at 113 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 45 degrees C, in the shade. J. May is not a reporter or an expert. I'm playing this because she, in her very human way, hits all the news you need when the heat wave gets to you.
It was actually, I just found out on the weather officially, it was 113 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 45 degrees Celsius. So if you can imagine, like, that's, we were in air conditioning, which most people have here because it's Australia, it gets boiling, you know, and we've got a huge hole in the ozone layer over us. So we were all just sitting, watching a movie, and next minute, that everything's, all the electricity's gone out. And I'm not joking, probably within, I reckon, about 10 minutes, it was just, we all started to, like, get boiling. And sweat was just pouring down our faces. And we have neighbours, our next door neighbour, Ricardo, he's from South America. He's 98, and we had to check on him. He was absolutely boiling. So he said that he was going to go and lay in a cold bath because he couldn't, it was just too much. Like, when you're talking this level of heat, 130, now this is what it was in the shade, okay? So it was 113 degrees or 45 degrees in the shade. So if you're like, if the sun's like beating down and you're in like a heated area, like a car or a house with no cooling, it's going to be much hotter. So it's literally like being in an oven. So we rang SPOSnet, which is our energy provider, and they told us, it could be up to 5 hours, which it was. I have been sitting in a cold bath for 5 hours with my son. Lucky we got a really, like, big square bath, filled it up with really cold water. We were just absolutely boiling. It's so hot that there's no one out. There was no one out. They were all inside. There's been, the hospitals are just filled. They're absolutely filled, apparently. Like, because I put it into Vic ambulance, paramedic, and it's just like, they were just like absolutely fit, chock-a-block. Like, ambulance, the wait for an ambulance is like so long too. So, like, what happens if, you know, something, you know, like me, I've got intracranial hypertension, I've got too much cerebral fluid. When I'm hot, it makes it so much worse. Like, I can have a seizure, I can have something happen, and what, they wouldn't be able to be here to come and help me or my son. It's just been a terrible, terrible day, and I've just been praying to Jesus. And I just think, imagine if, you know, really did go bad and this was like, this was our reality permanently, and there was a huge EMP or something, and this was our life. Like,
that was YouTuber J. May Stojanovic during a 113 degree heat event in Australia during January 2018.
Heatwave conditions have been observed in different parts of the country. Mumbai recorded the second highest temperature in March in a decade with 38.7 degrees Celsius yesterday. According to the Indian Meteorological Department, the next few days are likely to be hot in Mumbai with temperatures hovering around 41 degrees Celsius. The mercury level in Gujarat as well has crossed the 40 degree Celsius mark and is likely to increase further as per the Met Department.
But let's go to a place where Western news just falls off the end of the world. I'm talking about India. I have been there, and it was hot. Now with climate change, India is going way beyond hot. In fact, as you will hear, parts of India are already beyond the 2 degrees supposed safe target set by the Paris Climate Accord. They have already blown past that.
While I have showed you the annual increase for India, we have also done a seasonal anomaly chart for India. Seasons in India is divided in four parts. We have winters in January and February. We have pre-monsoon season, which we also call as summers, which is March to May. We have monsoon season, which is June to September. And we have post-monsoon season, which is October to December. Now, let me show you what the temperature increase in these four seasons look like on a spiral. The seasonal increase in temperature actually looks much more dangerous than the annual increase in temperature. In the three seasons, winter, pre-monsoon and post-monsoon, the temperature in India has already increased by more than 1.5 degrees over the baseline of 1901 to 1930. But if you look at just the winter month of January and February, the temperature anomaly is actually more than 2 degrees. In fact, in 2017, the temperature anomaly in winters was 2.95 degrees. It is only during the monsoon month when the temperature increase is about 1 degree Celsius. So in 3 out of 4 seasons, 9 months in a year, the temperature in India have breached the aspirational goal of 1.5 degrees set in the Paris Agreement. This is becoming dangerous much sooner than anticipated.
That was Chandra Bhushan at the Center for Science and Environment in New Delhi, India. In an article published March 29, 2018, Isha Bajpai reports, quote, according to a recent collaborative study by the University of California and IIT Bombay, summer mean temperatures in the country have increased substantially from 1960 to 2009. Southern and western India experienced 50% more heat waves between 1985 and 2009 than the previous 25-year period. Similarly, heat wave days and mean duration of heat waves have increased by approximately 25% in the majority of India, the study observes. End quote. The nonprofit DownToEarth.org further reports that the government of India really has no way to record heat deaths. Only heat strokes and heat exhaustion are counted when they are reported or examined at all. But heat kills many other ways, from organ failure to strokes and more. Each year since 2015 in India, the government reports somewhere between 1,000 or 2,000 heat deaths, but the real number is much, much higher. And we are just beginning to enter the age of heat. Let's get to our feature interview. We don't need to blame the Russians or even Donald Trump for killing a government response to our climate danger. It turns out an American cabal of billionaires has been at it for decades. How do the super wealthy and their politicians talk about climate change? As superstorms and superfires strike, what has been going on in the shadows? Dr. Lawrence Shoup has a PhD in history. He's been a social activist since the 1960s. Shoup has written many articles for magazines like Zed Magazine or Z Magazine and published 5 books. His first in 1977 was on the Council on Foreign Relations, and his latest in 2015 is Wall Street's Think Tank, The Council on Foreign Relations and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics, 1976 to 2014. Chapter 8 of that book is called Fiddling While the Earth Slowly Burns, The Council and the Ecological Crisis, 1990 to 2014. And that's what I hope to talk to Larry about. Larry Shoup, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me on, Alex.
It's a pleasure to meet you finally. I have read some of your work before. Larry, activists in the 1970s and the 80s, we knew about the Council on Foreign Relations, but I'm not sure millennials do. What is the CFR?
It's a private organization, corporate-dominated. In fact, I call it a capitalist class organization because the top leadership is capitalist class people who are interested, of course, in organizing the world to increase their wealth and accumulate capital. but they also have a very important component of experts, people from the main universities in the United States, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Columbia, Johns Hopkins, Chicago, Stanford. Those are the universities that the council draws on for some of their academic and intellectual leadership. And that's an important component because the council wants to define issues in the way they think they should be defined and then mobilize a consensus among the capitalist class along, you know, for whatever they want to do in a particular situation, and then go out to the educated public through their magazine, Foreign Affairs, that's their magazine, and get a consensus around a particular policy. So they're strategic planning. They have a very important part of their work as a think tank, that is study groups that bring together these capitalists, bring together the academics, and define a problem, decide on solutions, and then disseminate those solutions into the larger public through the media. They have lots of contacts with media. It's a very large organization. It's a private organization, but they've got 5,000 members, individual members, U.S. citizens, and then they have about 150 corporate members, which are the big multinationals. So this is a very important and powerful organization behind the scenes. Their people go into the government. Characteristically, they become the leaders in the government. In Bill Clinton's administration, for example, Clinton himself was a member of the council, the Secretary of the Treasury, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, etc., were all members of the Council on Foreign Relations. So that was typical. The current Trump administration is a bit atypical because they have less representation of council individuals, but they have a very large representation of council representatives from council corporate members. Corporate members, by the way, can be international. So Deutsche Bank is a corporate member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Eni, the Italian oil multinational, is a corporate member of the Council on Foreign Relations. They also have a global advisory board, which brings together very important capitalists and leaders worldwide into their advice network. So the Council is this very important, big, complex organization. I've just, you know, gone through it in detail in Wall Street's think tank, of course, but it really requires a study to understand it completely. But that's, in brief, what it's all about.
And what was the first climate report by the Council on Foreign Relations?
Well, they didn't really have a study group on this, but in 1990, they had a book that came out, a council book. They put out their own books. They put out tens of thousands of various kinds of products, books, blogs, reports, articles by their staff. They have about 100-person intellectual staff at the council that puts out lots of academic products. So one of their products is books, and they had a book called Sea Changes, where they talked a little bit about the climate crisis. The Sea Changes was mostly about talking about the changes in the world at the time, led by the decline and demise of the Soviet Union. But they did have Robert Heidelberger, a very important intellectual, had been a member of the council for a while, although he dropped out later on. And he talked about how there was a looming confrontation of capitalist dynamics with the limits of ecological tolerance. Due to fossil fuel use, as we all know, carbon emissions are rising, and this, of course, creates a climate effect, global warming. That's one part of the ecological crisis. And the council, of course, doesn't want to talk about all parts of the ecological crisis, because that would be a holistic understanding of it. And they're interested in a more narrow understanding of it, just dealing with part of it. And so the first one, really, the first time they really talked about the ecological crisis was in 1990. And Heidelberger said that the political will was the problem. There's not enough will to make the changes needed to prevent climate change. Government intervention was required. The market role, which, of course, the council is a capitalist organization dominated by big capitalists, like David Rockefeller earlier, today David Rubenstein, a billionaire, is the chairman of the council. They're interested in market relations. They're interested in neoliberalism, more privatization, more market power, whereas in order to solve the climate crisis, you have to have more government intervention. So Heidelberger pointed that out and said that this was going to be a big problem, and there was a question whether capitalism could absorb the drastic restructuring which is going to be necessary in order to save the planet. Our planet is in dire straits, I think, and human beings are under threat of extinction in a very short time, a few decades, I think. It's a dire situation. We're seeing the beginnings of some real serious things with hurricanes, with droughts, floods, fires, all the things that we notice that are going on the planet. The ocean is getting in serious shape. Oxygen is depletion in the ocean, acidification in the ocean, pollution of the ocean. These things are all extremely dangerous for life on Earth, including human life on Earth. So we have to challenge capitalism. We have to overthrow capitalism and have a different system. I believe we have to have an eco-socialist system that's fully democratic, that has ecological principles as the main thrust of the society, not getting more wealth for people who are already super wealthy. So anyway, that was the first in 1990. Then it went on, and they actually had a study group. They waited. Heidelberger kind of warned them that this is a really important topic, but it's a difficult one because it deals with the whole capitalist accumulation situation, which is what the capitalists want to keep accumulating. They have no limits to how much money they want to get. Unfortunately, the people that run our society and so many societies in the world. So then they had a study group finally in 1998, which was called the Victor Study Group. That was not interested in changing capitalism. It was more focused on technological solutions and also the Kyoto Protocol, which the United States never subscribed to. But, of course, when we start talking about these UN-organized protocols like the Kyoto Protocol and the Paris Agreement, unfortunately, it's mostly PR. There's nothing very serious behind these. It's mostly telling people everything's fine, don't worry, we've got the Kyoto Protocol, and, of course, that collapsed, and now we have the Paris Agreement, which, of course, Trump, who's a climate denier, doesn't even want to subscribe to, but it's very weak in any case, and it's not going to solve the problem. We need kinds of things like we had during World War II when we wanted to have the atomic bomb. There was an all-out effort on that. We have to have that kind of a scale of effort in order to solve the problem. So anyway, the first study group was this Victor Study Group in 1998, and it just came up with some tax. It said it recommended emission trading, which is another weak solution that you have in some places. You have it in Europe and you have it in California, but it mostly results in cheating. There's not really very much limits put on emissions. And of course, again, that's just only part of the problem. We also have ocean acidification. We have a number of other issues around the ecological crisis that are very serious besides climate change.
Now, according to your research, Larry, ExxonMobil played along with these climate change is a real threat reports from the Council on Foreign Relations, where they were members. But at the same time, ExxonMobil donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to establish the Heartland Institute, one of the biggest denial outfits anywhere. Does the CFR ever criticize its members, or do they vet who's allowed in? Do they ever kick anybody out?
I don't know of any case where they kicked anybody out. People have dropped out, various people, because they got, for one reason or another, the council was either too progressive, which sounds strange, but extreme reactionaries will see the council as too progressive. Which, of course, I think it's in a way short of being progressive, but that's right. ExxonMobil was very important in is very important in the council. Their previous chairman was a member of the council, and they've been a corporate member for many decades. Representative members of the ExxonMobil were in these study groups. There was the first Victor study group. There was a second one as well, that the ExxonMobil representative was there, along with BP as well, representative from British Petroleum. So they have them in the study group in order to listen to what they have to say and maybe be convinced. So these study groups, as a result, their recommendations are watered down at best. And so ExxonMobil went into those not necessarily saying, oh, I'm going to go along with the council's program. They're going to change the council or influence the council's program to make sure it fits in with their needs. In the case of this first study group, the Shell, the guy that was the chair of the study group, Rodney Nichols, was a consultant for Shell Technical Ventures. So they were talking about technologies that might limit global warming, but they were complementary to Shell Oil's profit. So you know you're not going to get anything very serious out of that result of that study group. So that's right. ExxonMobil has been involved in this. They are funding climate, or they have been at least in the past, heavily funding climate deniers. But by the end of that study group program in 2009, they were able to get their program through the House of Representatives of the United States, and that was a cap-and-trade program. Like I say, that kind of system results in a lot of cheating, and so it doesn't really do that much to change things. But they failed in the Senate to get it through the Senate. It did pass closely in the House in June 2009. This was a council program, and it passed in the House, but then the Senate, because the Republicans totally opposed it, and BP, ConocoPhillips, Chevron, ExxonMobil, and Shell all lobbied. Those are all corporate members of the Council on Foreign Relations. They all lobbied against the program. So they weren't on board, even though they'd been involved in all these study groups that the council had had. They still weren't on board with even cap and trade, which I guess is very weak and doesn't do that much. And so by 2009 and a little bit after that, a few more years after that, the council kind of gave up on even trying to do anything to try to limit the pollution and all the problems of climate change and the ecological crisis, and just went into denial. Not directly denial, but in effect denial, saying we have to have growth, therefore we need to be using fossil fuels. Capitalism requires growth. It's a expand or die system, and therefore we're not going to do anything about it. So Richard Haass is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's been the president since around 2004, I think he became president. He's still the president. He wrote a book in 2013, Foreign Policy Begins at Home, and he said, if you have low growth for too long, you have dire consequences of class frictions. Now, that's one thing the council doesn't like to have, is class frictions, because it's a capitalist organization, and the capitalists don't even like to talk about class or capitalism. That's kind of almost forbidden, except in their own circles they might talk about it. But as far as the broader public, they'd much rather talk about race or gender, because that doesn't get into their profits and into their power. So he said this would cause class frictions. That is, there would be the rank-and-file people who aren't getting extremely wealthy on all these fossil fuels. They might rebel against this. So we better keep growth going. And growth going demands using fossil fuels. So they kind of threw up their hands by the time this book came out, 2013, and said, well, we've had these study groups. It didn't result in anything that's useful from our point of view, so I guess we're just going to have to adapt to global warming. Well, and the other aspects of the ecological crisis. Well, as we know, that is the road to destruction, and we're seeing that with the climate chaos that's now developing on our planet.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith, and for a very long time, my guest, Dr. Larry Shoup, has been tracking a shadowy group of power brokers called the Council on Foreign Relations, and we are looking at their record on climate change. I wanted to ask you, Larry, what are the findings of the 2009 CFR report, The Canadian Oil Sands, Energy Security versus Climate Change?
Well, this was one of that five study groups that I mentioned, and they decided because the tar sands are worth an estimated, at that time they estimated, the tar sands were worth $8.5 trillion. And so they had this long analysis about the geopolitical aspects, the national security aspects, the climate aspects, and decided that because it was so valuable, they concluded that rapid tar sands development should continue. And so this, of course, as we know, is extremely dirty oil. It's really a bitumen, and you have to, in order to get it, you have to cut down some boreal forests in Canada that are, you know, ecologically, have been ecologically pristine, and create a wasteland that's it's absolutely horrible. If you look at a picture of the forest and the rivers before they mine the tar sands, and then you look at the disaster afterwards, a big pit spreading over the landscape. And, of course, this is ecologically disastrous because, of course, we need those trees to absorb carbon. So anyway, they concluded that the tar sands development should continue. Now, of course, we do face a different situation because in those days, this study group was 2004, and since then, fracking has become a big thing, and the U.S. is not as short of oil as it was. The U.S. used to import something like 12 million barrels of oil a day. That was in 2006. Today, it's down to 1 million barrels a day, around that, because fracking has been so successful. So if they had another study group, they might come to a different conclusion, although we're not sure because the $8.5 trillion always, that's an unbelievable amount of money. And, of course, it's smaller than the trillions of value of coal or the trillions of value of Saudi oil or some other country's oil. It's still less than that, but it's still a vast figure. And, of course, the capitalists running the Council on Foreign Relations, that's their main concern, is getting more profits. So the tar sands were approved.
And what was the independent task force and what is its relationship to the Council on Foreign Relations?
Well, that's an interesting thing because the Council portrays itself. If you read their own documents, they say, oh, we're an organization that's nonpartisan. We're Democrats and Republicans. We don't take policy positions. Of course, this is all a front. They do take policy positions all the time. They take it in various ways. Their president is always elaborating different policy positions, as are their other leadership people are advocating lots of policy positions. And they go in and out of the government when they make policy. So they're in and outers in the sense that they're in private enterprise or and also members of the council, and then they go right into the government. There's many cases where the government has taken wholesale many people from the board of directors of the council right into the government as top leaders. Of course, they're always very high leadership, including the secretary level. So the council says there that they don't take policy positions. They get around it in various ways, and one of the ways is this independent task force idea. So they say, we're going to choose a task force and give it a topic, and we're going to choose the people on the task force. All the people there will come from the council, many of them council members, but not always all of them council members. They're maybe, you know, 15 out of 20 will be council members. The others will be some other people that have on a particular topic. Say, for example, North Korea. The council just had a study group on North Korea, which they recommended very harsh measures against North Korea, very much in line with Trump's positions, even though, like I say, they don't have as many council people at the leadership level in the Trump administration as other administrations. But still, they came up with this policy that's very close to the Trump positions on North Korea. So they bring in some people who may be expert on something that they're interested in that particular. So anyway, this independent study group ploy, it's kind of a ploy where the council can make recommendations and say, oh, we didn't make any recommendations. So they choose these people, they choose the topic, and then they say, okay, now you're independent. So that's what the independent task force, and there was this independent task force that they had in 2008, 2010, and it was called the Independent Task Force on Climate Change, and they came up with cap and trade as the solution to the problems of climate change. And so it was a very high-powered study group, and that's the one that recommended to the U.S. Congress that you should have cap and trade, and it was, as I mentioned, it was passed in June 2009. By the House, but not passed in the Senate because there wasn't enough consensus within the capitalist class. And this is something interesting when we start to get into consensus among the capitalist class. There's still a lot of consensus within the capitalist class. But Trump has, because he's not a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, he's kind of a nouveau riche. With another, I can backtrack and say the Council is a plutocratic organization, in the sense that the old plutocracy has been dominant in the Council on Foreign Relations for a long time. The Rockefellers were very prominent in the early days, but there were also other prominent American families the Mellons and the DuPonts and all of those were very prominent in the Council from a very early date. And Trump is kind of a nouveau riche and does not connect as well as previous administrations with the Council on Foreign Relations. They've had to work a little bit harder to try to get him to go along with their policies. It seems to be that that's the case, and they're making recommendations that are very much in line with what he's wanting to do. And so they still have a lot of power, but there is some dissonance within the capitalist class right now. I'm still, because a lot of this is happening behind the scenes, I'm still kind of scoping it out because there's a paperback version of Wall Street's think tank that's going to come out, and I'm writing a afterword for it. And so the afterword has to deal with the upgrades or the changes in the council leadership and also the Trump administration and how that fits into the council, and then a couple case studies, the tax reform, so-called, which is just a tax gift to the rich in the United States and the corporations in the United States. That one has been recommended by the council for a long time. That's exact tax reform we're very close to, the tax reform, so-called, that the Republicans have passed. So that case study is pretty clear. The North Korean one is also pretty clear that the council's recommendations are being followed by the Trump administration. So there'll be a couple case studies in that. So anyway, there's a paperback edition of Wall Street's think tanks going to be coming out, and I'm working on that. So I am dealing with this question of within the power structure, what's going on, because it is interesting and it is important, and there seems to be more conflict than in the past.
But in the end, though, Larry, from my reading of your work as it is now, it sounds like the Council on Foreign Relations looked at climate change, realized it would bring serious chaos, including damage to the oceans and extreme weather events that were going to be very expensive and heat deaths. They knew all that, but they still said, we need capitalism no matter what, so we have to accept climate change. We just have to accept it, and that seems to be their policy.
That is. You're right. This is lamentable, but they're imprisoned by their own mentality, and they can't get beyond it. And so that means the average person, the rank and file, and the intellectuals need to work on uniting the population around a program. I call it, this is subject to a dialogue and discussion and struggle among, thousands and millions of people. But I think eco-socialism is the answer. That is a fully ecological program, similar to what the Green Party's transitional program, but that's, I think we can go beyond that with the ecological program that we need, was fully democratic, but then could begin to implement some serious changes that we need in order to save the planet.
Do you think capitalism has to crash with the stocks and big corporations going bankrupt to save the Earth?
Yes, I do. I think that's going to be the first step, and I think Trump's policies might lead to that because he doesn't want to have regulations. The capitalist people of the Council on Foreign Relations, they're more interested in having some regulations. Trump wants to get rid of all of them, and his people in the very limited perspectives of the Republican Party in the United States now, it's very narrow in its thinking. That could cause a crash. Unfortunately, there'll be a lot of suffering. I'm not in favor of people suffering, but we need to have, I think we need to work on the municipal level to try to assure that there is locally grown food in everywhere we can do it, in vacant lots, in backyards, and also, of course, agroecological types of gardening and agriculture is very good for the earth in the sense it can draw out carbon. If you have an agroecological system like no-till farming, where you don't dig up the ground. When you dig up the ground, you allow carbon to go in the atmosphere. If you don't dig up the ground, but you have an intensive type of agriculture, you can pull carbon out of the biosphere. So that's one of the solutions that we can work on, is a municipal oriented, locally grown food that could save the earth over time if we extend that kind of agriculture to a much bigger basis. Industrial agriculture, with all this use of fossil fuels, pesticides, chemicals, is a dead end.
But we still have consumerism. I mean, I want to buy a new truck. I want to buy a new car. I want a new TV. I want more and more. We're all part of this. I mean, we'd like to blame the capitalists, but we want all the powers that fossil fuels give us as well. So it's pretty hard to assign the blame. And the other problem that I have is that you're talking about the workers are going to save us, which was Karl Marx's idea as well. But now what we have is very low-paid workers. We have an unhealthy population, a lot of addiction. People are stressed out, working two or three jobs. They're in debt, or maybe they depend on the government directly. So it seems almost like there's zero working-class consciousness in America. And some of those who do recognize themselves as workers voted for Trump. What do you say?
I think you've put your finger on a lot of our problems. But education and the realities that people are going to be facing. Remember, we're just seeing the beginnings of some catastrophes that are going to be pushed on us, and people are going to have to get local and start getting in communities like community councils, neighborhood councils, to talk about solving problems. And I think in those forums, more radical measures will come forward, and people will realize that what our better future is for everybody is not consumerism and getting more and more consumer goods, but community and caring for each other and survival with more free time and less goods. I don't know what's going to happen. Obviously, nobody does. But that's what I would hope would happen, is that we focus on municipal power and we get away from the consumerism, which does affect us all. That's what's leading to that kind of the lack of community, the lack of consciousness, the lack of caring for each other is what leads, the lack of love, what leads to the opioid epidemic, what leads to these other things, the isolation of people instead of working in communities. Our communities have been destroyed, and that's why people are alienated, and they'll grab on to anything, and therefore many workers did vote for Trump, of course. More workers voted for Clinton, but of course Clinton was very close to the Council on Foreign Relations. Hillary Clinton was not a member, but her husband's a member, her daughter's a member. She went to the council in 2009 and said, when she was Secretary of State, and said, we get a lot of advice from the council. I hope you keep advising me. This is the Secretary of State telling the council, I get all my advice from you, a lot of it, and I want to keep getting advice from you. Thanks a lot. Where's the power? The power there is at the Council on Foreign Relations. So Clinton wasn't a good choice for people. And because we have a really limited electoral system, which is not very democratic, it's run by the billionaires, it's run by the media, the billionaire media, there's no public financing, there's no proportional representation, there's no instant runoff voting, or, ranked choice voting. So the voting system is backward, it's first past the post, there's billionaires investing in politicians, so of course the consciousness is low. Fox News, of course, is the epitome of a media that's manipulating people, making them dumb, and it's owned by and run by Rupert Murdoch, and he's been a member of the Council on Foreign Relations for a long time, although he was a member for over 25 years, and then for some reason he disappeared from the membership list in recent years, the last couple of years. So I don't know why he quit. I don't think he was kicked out, but he did. No longer appears, but Rupert Murdoch and Fox News have been an important source of a lot of these problems, the mass media. So we have to, as a population, as a people, organize ourselves to fight this in order to survive. Because, like I believe, we're on the cusp of some very even more serious ecological disasters and destruction of some ecologies. The ocean is in serious trouble, and that is a source of a lot of our oxygen and an important part of our food. So we destroy the oceans like so much that we are destroying. We're moving on the road to destroying ourselves. And unfortunately, the Council on Foreign Relations has given up on doing anything about it. So we, the people, have to, even though there's all these formidable obstacles, which you correctly point out.
Well, maybe we have to get knocked down a little further before we stand up and fight for an Earth that's worth living in for our kids and grandkids.
I think that's right, and I have a couple grandkids that I'm very concerned about, and I do want other people to think about that and stand up. Of course, you know, we know that revolutions have only occurred when things were dire. You know, Russia in 1917, things were extremely dire. There's nothing like that in the United States or these other countries that you have mentioned today. But things are going to get worse if we kind of think about how bad it is going to get and start to try to mitigate or prevent by moving and raising people's consciousness, moving forward towards the revolution that we need. And, of course, I talk about some alternatives. Eco-socialism, I outline in the concluding chapter what an eco-socialist society is. It's a different civilization. It's a different kind of, totally different kind of civilization. So that's what we need to move towards. I don't have all the answers, but together we can have all the answers. We can dialogue and come up with the answers as a people. And that's what we need even internationally, of course, beyond just the United States and other allied countries. We need to be international and go beyond that as a people, as a species.
From Chicago, we've been talking with Dr. Larry Shoup about his book, Wall Street's Think Tank, The Council on Foreign Relations and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics from 1976 to 2014. You can find out more at lawrenceshoup.com, and that's Lawrence with no W, S-H-O-U-P. And you can find more links in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Larry, thank you so much for spending some great time with us.
Yeah, thank you, Alex. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Radio EcoShock.
Apparently, it doesn't matter if the world is authoritarian, democratic, communist, or capitalist. All those forms of government support expanding the economy, draining more resources, and pushing pollution out into the land, water, and atmosphere. Do we need industrial civilization to crash in order to survive at all? The West Coast author and deep green thinker Derek Jensen says yes. I interviewed Derek in 2007, and wow, that was 11 years ago. He's produced a lot since then. So pretty soon, when I've drunk in some more Deep Green Jensen, we will do another interview with Derek. To get you started, I'm going to toss you right into the deep end with an audio from one of Derek's most recent videos. It's called More Thoughts on Technics, as uploaded to YouTube on March 11th, 2018. Good luck.
So we've talked before about authoritarian and democratic technics. Lewis Mumford talked about how technologies don't arise in a vacuum, but they emerge from and then give rise to certain social structures. And he found they fell into sort of two categories, democratic and authoritarian technics. And a democratic technic would emerge from and give rise to democratic power structures. An authoritarian technic would emerge from and give rise to authoritarian power structures. And a great example would be anything that involves mining, because nobody wants to get into a mine. And so you need an authoritarian power structure to enforce people getting into the mine. So if you have any technology that requires mining, it's going to require the entire social system that goes with it. And then once you have a technology, it affects how you perceive the world. So for example, if you have automobiles, that affects how you perceive the world. That makes it, you know, I live 3 miles from a grocery store. We could talk about grocery stores as a technic too. Anyway, I live 3 miles from a grocery store. So if I forget something at the grocery store, it's no big deal because I can just drive back and get it. But if I had to walk for 3 miles, that would change how I perceive going to the grocery store. So they're also authoritarian techniques, not only because they give rise to authoritarian power structures, but because they themselves become authoritarian and they can run the society. So that's one reason, for example, that cities are designed for cars more than they are for human beings. We've created this thing, and then suddenly we have to design the entire living space around that. Or that's also why, as this culture is killing the planet, and as global warming is just running amok, that's one reason that very, very few of us are the only ones who are talking about stopping industrial civilization, because industrial civilization is in charge. It is more important to these people than a living planet. And so that's how technologies can come to control us. And so why is that important to be able to name? And I'm going to step back from that for a second and talk about, I still remember when I was in my 20s, a friend of mine called me up and she was reading a book on post-traumatic stress disorder. And she started reading off some of the symptoms of PTSD. You know, I was abused as a child and she was too. And there were, you know, insomnia, night terrors, a strong startle response. And as she was reading off this list of symptoms of PTSD, we were both just marveling. Someone is describing our experience. And I know similarly, I know someone who has been in the past couple of years diagnosed with bipolar. And when he was diagnosed, then a friend sent him some literature on it, and he was weeping with gratitude because someone was describing his experience, and they were able to put a label on it, and they were able to put to bring. Here's another way to look at this: is that, you know, I have Crohn's disease, and it wasn't diagnosed for quite a while. I had severe diarrhea, I had bleeding, I had all these problems, weight loss, nausea, vomiting, terrible pain. I had all these symptoms. And then to find out, to get a story, this is Crohn's disease that leads to these symptoms, to get a story that made sense of all these disparate symptoms was incredibly helpful. It's like a doctor friend of mine says that the first step toward proper treatment is correct diagnosis. And so that's one of the ways that naming authoritarian techniques has been really helpful for me. I didn't name them, Lewis Mumford did. But reading Mumford about that, that was one of the reasons it was really helpful, is because it helped me to make sense of a lot of disparate facts. I kept asking myself for decades, who's in charge? How is it that we human beings have created social systems where in which most of the people are spending most of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do? In other words, working a job that you have to pay rent, to survive on the planet. And that's, how did we create a system? How did a system get created that is so, in which not even the humans are primarily benefiting from the system? It's just where most of us are spending most of our time doing things we don't want to do. That just seems crazy to me. Or why would you create a system that systematically destroys the land? I didn't understand any of that until Mumford really helped with that, with putting a frame. I suddenly understood how these technologies can end up essentially driving society. So I think that this particular video is in some ways about techniques and why it's important to be able to name them and how that helps. And then also it's about the larger importance of, if you have a constellation of problems, to be able to, that insight helped make sense of the otherwise nonsensical behavior. Suddenly all our behavior made sense. And Mumford's analysis of techniques helped make sense of so much nonsensical behavior. Why has there been a food production and distribution system created that leaves many people starving and that makes many people dependent upon the system as opposed to their land base? Why would that happen? Why would there be a system where most people are working jobs they don't love, and on and on and on? Why would cities be designed for cars? All these examples I've already given. Why would the military get huge amounts of money when schools are left without funding? And the authoritarian techniques notion helped me comprehend all that.
That was Deep Green thinker Derek Jensen in a YouTube video called More Thoughts on Technics. Find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org and find Derek at derekjensen.org. If all goes as planned, we will have a chat with Derek soon on Radio EcoShock. So map out your shade and your spot in the sun when it's safe enough to go out in the sun, and raise your voice against the machine. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening.